My name is Walt Wedeen, and what we're going to be talking about in this session is comes under the topic Thought for Food, Grasses We Eat. What I'd like to do is to give you an idea how I would proceed through this, but first of all, I'd like to say that if you have questions at any time, stop, because this is such a huge, broad topic that it can just go on. And so if you have a question, I think that's the best thing to do is take it when you can. What I'd like to do at the beginning is talk a little bit about the domestication of some of the plants that we have, and how this occurred, and how it's thought to have occurred, and then deal directly with the grasses, which include the grains, cereals, maize, which we had in two different forms up there tonight at supper. We had maize in the cornbread, and then we had maize represented in that ham that those pigs certainly ate a lot of corn.
Oh, really?
Oh, sure. I think we got plenty to talk about. Let me tell you a little bit about my background so you know where I'm kind of coming from. My background's all very agricultural. I grew up in northern Wisconsin, and I went through the university, agricultural school, University of Wisconsin, did a graduate work there. And then I worked at the University of Minnesota for USDA at St. Paul, and then spent almost 30 years at Iowa State. And retired now, and I'm still involved in consulting and associated with the University of Minnesota in agriculture. And so mine is very agricultural. When I start talking about food, I think of the physical and biological resources that we have. I'm not much of an authority. I should say I'm not an authority at all on the social and maybe the economical resources that impinge upon food in the broad sense. So, but that doesn't mean we can't talk about that if we wish. We can speculate about that, but I don't feel that I know much about it. So the physical and biological are the ones that I talk about. First of all, we have to just indicate that each of us are asked to suggest a couple of books that might be available in the bookstore, if you're interested. And there is one over there. The cover over on it is different. It'll be the third edition, but it still has the same title, Seed to Civilization, The Story of Food. It would be the third edition. It has a real bright cover. And this is... It isn't large, it's not expensive, and it's really a good book. It really is. If you're interested in getting a picture of the whole broad sweep of history, that's one. The other book that's over there that I suggested was The Gift of Good Land by Wendell Berry. Wendell Berry has written poetry and quite a few things that have to do with agriculture. And his approach has been to get agriculture on a little more sensible basis. And so his books come at that. And he lives in Kentucky, and he gets a little critical of agricultural colleges, you know, but it's good reading. He's a good writer. The book that he has is Onto a Good Land, and that's the other one over there. Those are the two I suggested. Now, this is a book of some years ago. You might even have this if you belong to the Book of the Month Club years ago. That's still going. I know we belong to Book of the Month Club, and I must have gotten this, 20 years ago. Food and History. And I think any library would have it by Tannehill, a woman. It's just really interesting. It's just awfully interesting reading. And... Then the one that's written by an agronomist, geneticist, at the University of Illinois. He's retired now, but he's quite a philosopher as well. Extremely scholarly, Jack Harlan, and this book called Crops and Man. Now, it's written 15 years ago. I suppose if he was writing it today and titling it, he'd maybe call it Crops and Humankind. But it's very good, and I think I'll read, I'll read a few quotes from him there. But
what was the name of the author on that?
Harlan? Jack Harlan, H-A-R-L-A-N. And there are a host of other books. If you go back into the resource library back here, you'll see many books that have to do with food and feeding the world, our mission to what we should be doing and so forth. And if you just read those books, I think that you might come away a little pessimistic about it all. I come from the agricultural side, like I say, and I think that there is optimism. We certainly can't say we're going to be able to solve the world food problems by producing more or anything else. But nonetheless, just to take the stance that we're all guilty and there's extreme pessimism should prevail, maybe we won't get the job done. So what I'll do as we go through these is share some of those thoughts with you as we go along. So those are the books that I think would be interesting to you. What is the aim that we would have here to consider together, even tonight, or if you can come more times? And what is my interest? Well, it's really to see if we can't strike a good centering balance of ecology, the use of our natural resources in an agriculture that is sustainable over time. Some people have painted agriculture as being sort of an economy of exploitation. And I know the objective should be something like maybe it's an economy of conservation instead. And it's interesting because some of the other session, in fact, right next door, I'm sure Larry Rasmussen and I were talking. It would be nice if we could be talking together because I'm sure there's some things that where they're coming at it from the standpoint of stewardship and the ethics of it all in relation to all of our environment. Whereas I'm trying to pick out agriculture. We have a lot we'd like to be talking to each other, but I think this is the only time we have a conflict doing it at the same time, so we should be able to talk about that later. Well, of course, the question you could ask is what is agriculture's role in the final analysis? What is the expectation of agriculture in relation to continuing to be able to supply this food and yet keep water quality where the public wants it? The land resource, the use of our soil, our plants and animals, genetic diversity. I mean, there are a lot of things that are going on. I think we'll, as we go along, we'll maybe be touching into those either directly or indirectly. Where I come from, I think, is for you, is something like this. If we put at the top land, and by that I mean maybe soil and water, these are two are very important basic resources. We're going to try to get down here to food, and we come on down from this. All of our food is going to arise back with the basic resource of land or soil, and possibly from aquatic sources, from water. And that's going to be combined with air. In the case of plants, we're going to have the process of photosynthesis here. That is where you take the carbon dioxide out of the air. Well, I should have really had this down one step yet. And then move on down to vegetation. In other words, you're taking carbon dioxide out of the air and you're getting all this green material we see, and the plants are growing every year. It's been there forever. It's been there since way back in the hunting-gathering time. is still there. Now science has helped to understand this more. And so we get vegetation. And we certainly see a lot of that around here. And then from the vegetation, you either shunt it directly to humankind, or man, which is a term that's been used before. It's not good terminology necessarily at Holden. And they've already put it through animals. And then it comes to humankind. So that's basically kind of a flow of our natural resources through down to food. Food for humankind. And as I said, we had a good example here at supper. You took vegetation, which is corn grain, and you made corn grain directly. We ate that tonight. Or it went here through pigs and we got pork and ham coming. Now, if that had been going here, this is where I think some of the agriculture's got a bit of a bum rap. I might as well bring that up here, because the beef industry has been criticized markedly coming through here with the beef industry, because they say that the beef industry, they're using up a lot of the corn, which could go directly to man. But it turns out that the beef animal, along with these deer that we see out here eating grass, the deer are not eating any corn. Beef wouldn't have to eat any corn either, because they're four-stomached animals, they're ruminants, and they really don't compete with man. See, they aren't competing with man, whereas the pig, being monogastric, is competing with us. So we ate pork tonight, or ham, which, if you want to take it to the final analysis, competes with us, whereas if we'd had beef, we could say, well, it doesn't, if it hadn't eaten corn. So there are many, many...
If a pig hadn't eaten that, we wouldn't have ham.
That's it. No. And the same thing is true, of course, for chickens, you know, the poultry industry. So there are a lot of things that we're into systems of agriculture that they just can't be shut off, you know, right away. They can be changed. And on the last discussion this week, which will be Saturday, I'm going to talk specifically about alternative agriculture. Mm-hmm. And just to kind of give you the idea of what's meant there is, simply what it is it's a coming together of ideas and what's been happening. If you have organic gardening or farmers over here on this side that say these people from the universities over here are using, they're recommending too, this is modern agriculture. This is called modern agriculture over here. Too many herbicides, pesticides, fertilizers, and so we got to go organic over here, and never the twain shall meet for a while. They won't even talk to each other. Okay? But they are now. Now they're beginning to talk together. And I put myself someplace in the middle here in the continuum. This is my background. Well, I was, as a kid in northern Wisconsin, we were over on this side. Then I went to the ag college, and agriculture changed and moved rapidly forward, so we're over on this side. But I've always been in the middle, because my specialty was working with grasses and forages and that thing, working with livestock. So what we're having now is this great possibility that can be called alternative agriculture in the middle. And there are a lot of exciting things happening on that. So that's a case of where it's coming together. Any questions on kind of the idea? So that what I'd like to lead up to tonight then is talk about the grasses that
we'll never go back to feeding beef grass and keeping the American people happy. I ate grass-fed beef in New Zealand.
You didn't like it?
Well, I don't care much about beef anymore at all. Uh-huh. So it didn't matter. But I mean, it certainly wasn't like prime beef.
Right. Well, the other thing is you should never say never, I guess.
No, right. That's yeah, what but it was a shock.
But I've eaten grass-fed beef in Uruguay in South America.
Have you? Uh-huh.
And they must have had a tremendous talent to be able to fix it, because I thought it was excellent.
Did you?
Well,
this was a grilled steak, you know, it was very, all I could think of was it was very fibrous.
But there should be ways to be able to do that, marinating and et cetera, you know, that can be done. So,
what makes a grass different from some other plant? What makes a grass grass instead of something else? What, I mean, what is there special about it that, is it jointed or something, or stem, or what?
Yeah, what I'll do is, I'll get into that, right. So what, in other words, we kind of take a look at them botanically and then come at, I'll end up talking about rice, and which is a grass, and wheat, which is a grass, and corn, which is a grass. So this family of grasses, the Gramineae, have, they're the foods that we eat all the time. See? And so when you say the word grass, that's just the bluegrass that you see on the lawn. It's a huge family. And rice is in with it. I'd like to quote one thing to you, because this at the start, just to why we should be interested at all in food, and maybe where did wheat come from, and how long have we had it, and so forth, since we eat bread here all the time, three meals a day, we're eating bread. And I've got three quotes. One is by a French entomologist, and he was a popular writer about insect life. He was a famous, he apparently wrote a lot of books about the lives of insects. Here's a quote from him, it must have been about 1875. "History celebrates the battlefields whereon we meet our death, but scorns to speak of the plowed fields whereby we thrive. It knows the names of the king's bastards, but cannot tell us the origin of wheat. That is the way of human folly." So that's pretty too much the point, that we should know a little more about. Another one, here's William Jennings Bryan, 1896, just about 100 years ago. The golden-voiced orator, I believe. He said, "Burn down your cities and leave our farms, and your cities will spring up again as if by magic. But destroy our farms, and the grass will grow in the streets of every city in the country." So, in other words, we just can't say, let's get rid of agriculture. Agriculture is guilty. How come they ever invented it in the first place, you know? We better deal with it. Here's something I wrote for some years ago. It was a book, or not a book, but a paper, An Approach to Solving World Food Problems. And this is just called Awareness. And I just read this before I came out here, and I thought, well, you know what, I can't say it much better than I said it then, I guess. "Food is a basic need for all people, rich and poor, powerful and weak, young and old, free and oppressed, citizens of this great country and others. That there will be food problems in the future is evident from projections of past events, from an increasing population, from a crunch on energy inputs used in the food industry, production, processing, distribution, preparation, and from evidences that an increasing percentage of the world's people are seeking higher quality diets. Each day, those of us here in the United States are made aware of many food-related problems and opportunities as well through mass communications, which dramatize the despair of a starving inhabitant of the African Sahel, or the irritation of the supermarket shopper as prices usually go up but seldom down. Both extremes can be appreciated by an Iowa farmer as he examines his wilted corn and he hears the complaint of the urban golfer who does not want rain on Sunday. There is small wonder that pessimism has come into vogue with respect to food. This ranges from mild concern by the average citizens for our domestic situation to downright hopelessness for helping on a solution of the world food problems." So I think this is, it just impinges on everybody. It really does. Some of these young folks that are here working as volunteers that maybe don't have as much of an understanding where food is coming from as some of you do. All the way to this Iowa farmer that's depending on that. And the only time I ever called in on a talk show was sort of related to this. I was driving and looking at some of our research in Iowa, and I had WHO Des Moines on, and that's quite a powerful station. And they had call-in, talk-ins, you know, and stuff going, and then they'd come in with the weather and the news. And I went to three different experiment farms to check out some of our experiments. And it was a Friday, and it was very, very dry. It was hot and dry. And they kept talking, these fellows on the talk shows, that it was going to be clear this weekend, good for golfing. And they kept on that all day, and I kept listening to this as I drove, you know, and I thought, this is crazy. And finally, just about, it was about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I was coming in just southeast of Ames, Iowa, coming home. I guess our boys had a little league ball at the game that night, so I used to go real early in the morning and make this route, and it was cutting in Ames. And this guy was, this was not a talk show anymore, but it was, he was playing some songs, and he'd comment in between, but talking about golf for the weekend, and a little bit of weather, and golf. And it just got to me, and I saw a phone booth over by the side of the road, and I just whipped my old Chevy over to the side, and plugged in a quarter in there, and I said, give me WHO in Des Moines. And I got this guy on the line. When he was playing a song, he'd be off the air. See? And so I got the fellow. And I said, see, I've been driving, I'm an agronomist. I work up at Iowa State University. I said, I've been driving the state all day, and I've been listening to you folks. And I said, do you guys realize that people throughout the whole state of Iowa that produce a lot of food, it's terribly dry out there? And most of you folks, all you've been talking about all day is your golf games this weekend. I said, do you know who listens to you? I said, I'm ticked off. And basically that was the gist of the conversation. And so I got in the car and started driving towards Ames. It was about, like I say, 20 miles. Played another song, nothing said. He played one more song, nothing said. And I came into Ames and he said, oh! He said, oh, I had an interesting call a little while ago. And he said, Walt Woodine from up at Iowa State University gave me a call. He said he's been traveling all over the state. He said, it's terribly dry. And, you know, he says, I'm kind of a skeptic sometimes. So I checked it out with our meteorologist, and he said, you know, it really is dry. He said, and I really hope you get some rain for the farmers. And so that was the end of the story. But it's the only time I've ever called, you know, but I'll never forget that.
Did you get any rain?
I don't recall, but eventually it got rain, yeah. But they used to speak about $1 million rain, you know, in Iowa. Or yeah. It was maybe worth multi-millions if for the corn crop. So that's... okay, so enough as sort of background to really kind of get into this, because it involves us all, it's important, I think there's a need for awareness and so on. Now, where did these crops come from when we start talking about the grasses? If Harlan's book is really good, because it sort of divides up history. Agriculture sort of originated back in about 8,000 B.C., 7 or 8,000 B.C., agriculture came on the move. And one question I might have that you could ponder a bit, I just always thought there was a pretty straightforward reason why agriculture arose, but there had been a lot of speculation by people as to why did agriculture start up in the first place. Picture this time when hunting and gathering, when people could just gather with seeds from these grasses that weren't domesticated yet, they could pick up enough seeds, and so there was a culture going for eons of time. And if you want a time scale on this, you'd look on here that since agriculture arose to now, let's say it's the width of that finger, the time when hunting and gathering existed is way, way back there someplace. Okay? So Harlan points out, I won't quote this, but he said, points out that they've gone back and they've figured out that this was a pretty stable time. It wasn't so bad. These people knew a lot. They knew how to pick fine seeds to eat. They had rites, they had of worship, and so on and so forth. Okay, so then agriculture comes into the picture. Why? Why did it originate? Can you think of some? 10,000 BC. Why would agriculture start? Now, by agriculture, we mean the domestication of a crop. In other words, you start literally saying, I'm going to grow this crop on purpose.
Larger population.
Population.
They can store it, maybe? Store it?
It was a less nomadic.
Save it till winter?
Less nomadic.
Yeah. Right, okay.
The hunting depleted? The source of the hunting?
Right, which was a pressure, a sort of a, yes.
A hunter-gatherer would require many more acres.
Right.
To feed his family,
right.
Than what if you had
right.
a cultivator.
Any others? Well, let me just tick these off quickly, because last week when I was talking, I spent quite a bit of time on this, but there were five, and all of you're all right, but the first one that I hadn't really known about until I started, one was they figured that agriculture was could have been sort of a divine gift, because going way back is evidence that they worshipped goddesses. There were goddesses of the crops. We didn't call them crops then, but so there was a sort of a divine gift. The second one would be agriculture arose because of religious reasons, that there was sacrifice of to worship these gods and goddesses, and they would sacrifice animals to catch a wild animal and actually sacrifice it. And somehow in the process, they began to realize maybe that animal could do them some good. Okay, so that and then maybe if they weren't so-called wealthy enough, or they maybe say, well, we'll sacrifice some seeds or something instead. Okay, another one is this crowding or pressure, the just population. Another one was it just happened by chance, which is very difficult. In other words, all of a sudden somebody found it. And I think Michener, in his book The Source, I haven't read that, but I've read about it, talks about some women that went down by a stream and all of a sudden they found some plants that would fit or something. I've got to read that. And the other one is they became less nomadic, and somebody said that. Because the hunting and gathering, you see, they couldn't stay in one spot. They really had to keep on the move. And so for some reason or another, as they settled into a spot, then they maybe said, hey, we noticed last year that this plant that we had here, the seeds might have grown, and even could have been on a grave, you see, they say it could have been on a grave where they buried somebody and put some seeds on there, wild seeds, for this person to go on into the afterlife and come out the next year, and they see these plants have grown up much higher than the other one, you know, just because of the decay and so forth. So there are all kinds of, but agriculture arose and it came out, it started. Now, that's when the domestication of some of these plants in those years apparently occurred. And now the ones we're interested in is if you start back at 10,000 BC, we won't talk about the animals, but let's start at about 10,000 BC. There's also evidence to show that, archaeological evidence to show that there were climatic shifts about this time in the Tigris and Euphrates area region of the Near East, the Middle East, that some quite substantial climatic changes, that the previous glaciations were moving back, and so therefore some of these other types of agriculture could come in there. So if you start about 10,000 and you go up to 0 BC or before the Common Era, the time of Christ, then someplace in here, maybe about 8,000 to 4,000, we have wheat coming in there. Corn didn't come in until later, and that was in the Hermes, came in the Americas. But most of these came in the Near East. So let's put corn here. And there's a little confusion about use of word term of corn, so we say maize, that describes it a little bit better. Wheat, corn, barley was maybe just a wee bit ahead of wheat. Barley, wheat, corn, rice, about 4,000. And that was over in the There were wild wheats that were growing, and they were different types. And wheat is particularly interesting because it has seven, they've been able to trace this. Wheat has seven chromosomes. And these are paired, so you have 14. When you have male, female, or it's fertilized, you have 14 chromosomes, and that's, so we have, and then there's also been a doubling of that, so there's 28, and a doubling of that, 56. Okay, so wheat has, the wheats have this, what they call, haploid, diploid, hexaploid, and so forth. Some of the wild wheats that were first found, one of them is called einkorn. Okay, that was growing then, you see, back before this time of 8,000. So that would have been growing back before here. And would have been used by hunters and gatherers. And at some place it came in there and they started to cultivate it. Now, it's interesting because Harlan was extremely innovative to try to find out more about these wheats. And he talks about it in his book. They went back and they found places in some spots in Turkey, Turkey where they still, these wild wheats, the einkorns, are still growing. So he actually went out there and he did a test. He went out himself to see if he could, how much time it would take for him to harvest enough of this wild wheat, how much he would have. And once he had gotten some of the bracts and so forth off it, if he'd have enough to live on. And he found out that he could go out and get about 2.5 kilos, and that's about 5 pounds, in 3 hours. And so he ends up concluding that, yes, it was very possible. A person could go out, and if you, before the pressure was be great enough, the population pressure, they could go out and they could harvest enough einkorn to get by. And there are evidences to show that even before this plant was grown by farmers, that there were archaeological evidence to show that they had grinding stones by which this could be ground. Now the bread making, from what I've been able to understand, came in maybe 5,000 BC. So someplace in there, maybe they had other ways, they just mixed it up with water or something else, they ground it, the wild wheats. And then as it came along, they found out that the wheats have a high gluten content. This is a protein. Distinguishes it from the other grains. Barley doesn't have that. Wheat has gluten content, a protein, and so that this is why it gives you a spongy type of a protein, so it'll hold the gases, and so it'll raise, you see. And so when they discovered the yeast, maybe the yeast just came in by chance, so somebody figured out the baking, what happens when they had fire. Fire came in 500,000 BC, so there was a long time. There was a long time from when fire was first known until all this domestication of these grains was going on. Now, again, so when you say domesticated, you start using the terms tame, wild, domesticated, all of these terms, it's not quite as simple as it might seem, because something like reindeer, or let's throw the term cultivating in there, cultivator, farmer. In Minnesota, they grow wild rice. Now, this truly is wild rice. It fits all the categories. It's domesticated to the extent that first of all, it's wild. It's not related to the other rice. It is a separate species. It's wild because even there is legislation in Minnesota that protects this for the Native Americans. In other words, they can go out and harvest this wild rice just the way it was in these certain lakes. And Harlan points out that this is maybe the way they learned how concepts of ownership and agriculture evolved. You can just picture that you would go out in a canoe like the Native Americans did, and they would go out and bind up the rice would be, they go out in a canoe and a bunch of the rice is growing out there, so they would bind this together so that when they came back later after it ripened, when they come by with the canoe, they can just put those heads over the canoe and beat out those seeds into the canoe. And then apparently they'd switch places, two people in the canoe, and they could fill a canoe with this wild rice. So that they theorized, shows that they not only understood that the seed was important, there was a concept of ownership, and if somebody in the tribe or clan went out and gathered this rice around together, that certainly somebody else didn't go out and take that. So that was the beginning of concepts of ownership and sort of a stewardship of cultivation. Well, so then now what do you have? You have wild rice being grown farming, or wild rice farming. Well, you have rice farming and wild rice farming in the state of California as well as rice farming. And they're two different species, the Asian rice. So here it's a wild plant. You'd say it's still a wild plant, but it's a cultivated, or it's not cultivated. The same thing is true of reindeer. Reindeer has never been domesticated. In other words, it just has never been domesticated per se, because Harlan points out in animals, you really have to have sort of a genetic shift occur in that animal over time that it becomes domesticated. Reindeer or not, but they still farm reindeers. Mm-hmm. Reindeer. So there, but I don't think that there are any people in Turkey maybe still go out and harvest the native einkorn wheat. I don't know, but maybe not. Now, one country is very interested in this, where they've been able to track down some of these things about the hunter-gatherers versus cultivation, is in Australia. Because it's relatively recent times when you got the Aborigines, about 200 years when they first, since Australia. Before that, there were no domesticated plants, no domesticated animals in Australia up to about 200 years ago. And so you can go back in there and study, you know, and they found out that, sure, these Aborigines got along fine. They were getting along fine. They have certain rites and rituals and on and on. So that Harlan ends up saying that why in the world did you ever start agriculture? And some modern day people, I have a paper somebody wrote, they said agriculture is the culprit. You know, why did they do that? They had a nice growing society way back then. Why did we get into agriculture? And now we're up in this present day when we've got all this go, and well, it's kind of a $64,000 question, isn't it? I guess the better question is how we're going to make agriculture sustainable and into the future, and so that it serves mankind or humankind better. Any comments, questions about any of this?
It's interesting that the wild rice, rather than the domesticated, is the most expensive.
Right. Certainly is, isn't it?
And it's loaded by quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're living over in Malaysia, and I did quite a bit of time in Sarawak, East Malaysia, which is in Borneo, working with the people that you read about, tropical rainforests, the Kunans. And those people and several other local tribes are still practicing the slash and burn nomadic farming. And the point of sacrificing a wild boar or whatever to increase the harvest or pray to the gods is still going on. And the rice there, the wild rice that they're harvesting, is by far superior in flavor and nutrition to most of the rice you can buy locally.
Is that right? Yeah. They still use the, is this the brown rice then? Or the
brown, they have got all kinds. They have brown and red and purple and just, it's wonderful to look at and taste. It's sort of like what you buy here, which they call the wild rice, but
those are two different families.
Yeah, right. But it's certainly a wild variety, and they've got many different varieties.
Yeah, I think this wild rice is the precursor of the rices that we normally eat, whereas the wild rice of Minnesota is another one. Right. This is it's a really interesting Let's talk about rice a little bit, as long as you, first of all, let's talk about the grasses, because that was the question over here about the grasses. They're both, I was going to take wheat first and then rice and see how far we get. The grasses, in Isaiah 46, it says, all flesh is grass. So there's been quite a bit written about that. Now, what's the meaning of that Bible verse? All flesh is grass. Well, maybe the little diagram I drew in the beginning. Maybe they understood that, you know, really, all flesh does, it all starts with photosynthesis, you know what I mean?
Well, I would think you'd say that because when you get down to it, probably 95% of all plants that you eat are monocots of the grass family.
That's right.
And it's the other nice things, tasty things, like the tomatoes, perhaps, that are nice to eat, but they're not of the grass family. And if you take your barley, your corn, your maize, your oats, and your wheat, that takes it all. Mm-hmm. And if you were without those, the world would be in a pretty sad place, I think.
Absolutely. You think they knew that back at the time when Isaiah was... See, we know that now, that they're monocots. They maybe didn't know that.
I don't think they used those words.
Yeah, all right. That's right, we don't, because monocots and the monocotyledons and the dicotyledons, they might have observed these differences way back then in the way they emerged from the soil. And the big question, as we talked about hunters and gatherers last week, was a question I said is, what did they know and when did they know it? You know, sort of an investigation type of approach to it. Yes, it is true. And the grasses as a family, or the Gramineae, are really maybe the most important family of plants that we have on the north. For those of you that, if you haven't, you know, studied the botany or biology or something, this Latin nomenclature is used to give each of the various species of animals and plants a specific name. So that I was recently in Poland about 4 or 5 weeks ago doing some agricultural work, and when the way we ended up communicating on certain grasses was by using Latin names. Because they had a common name in Polish and we got one in this country. But when I said Dactylus glomerata, these people, the Poles, through the interpreter, they all started talking right away. They knew what I was talking about. I was talking about orchard grass and they're talking about the same thing, but you know, the orchard grass didn't mean anything, and their Polish name didn't mean anything to me. So, and Linnaeus, the Swede, he's the one that did most of this work with classification. Well, anyhow, that's a family. Gramineae is a family. And it's one of the, one of the larger families. But to give you some idea of the importance, it's interesting that when you think back, even in the Bible, that first, according to the creation story, first it created the food plants, before he created fish, birds, animals, and man. So that indicates that from the standpoint of biblical history, that's very important. The flowering plants, what we're talking about here when we're talking about grasses, we're talking about flowering plants that have flowers, and in those flowers, which we have seeds, and some of these seeds, which is a kernel of wheat, is used by man or humankind. There are about 200,000 types of flowering plant in the world. There are only about 3,000 of them that have been used to some extent by humans. And about 200 of these have been domesticated, and there are about 12. There are about 12. I was mentioning, you named about 4 or 5. There are about 12 that really our food system depends on. Rice, wheat, barley isn't quite as important in there. And in the book here, he has a listing. Sugarcane, because there's a lot of sugar. You see, we use a lot of sugar. Potatoes comes in there about 10 or 12.
Rye
is minor.
Is it minor?
Yeah, it's more minor, but it's important. So that is the thing that can be a little bit scary when you start to think about it. And as as you look into the future, what's happened is that the genetic base of these, for the larger this production, keys back to certain things. So wheat, rice, maize are the important ones. That's what I wanted to bring out to you. Now, let's talk about the rice a little bit. It's very, very interesting. Because rice, of any of these cereals which that are grasses, rice feeds more people than any other of the cereals that we have. Wheat is more extensively grown throughout the world, but rice is rice feeds more people. And for example, the saying is used quite often that Southeast Asian eats as much rice in 1 week as Americans eat in a whole year. And that's maybe even stretching it. It might be more like versus a day. So they really, and you've seen that, of course. Rice in the morning, rice at noon, rice in the evening. And so it's very, very dependent on that.
When you figure Indonesia is the fourth most populous country in the world.
Fourth, no?
Yeah, fourth or fifth. And that's all they eat, essentially, is rice.
Right.
And then you throw in China and India.
Right.
Plus the others in Japan, that's it.
Yeah. Well, so rice feeds more people than any other than wheat. It's a basic food of more than half of humankind. Speaking of basic foods, and I'll kind of talk about them both together, wheat, it was said that the Romans, when they discovered bread making in Egypt, and it was passed on to the Greeks, and the Greeks passed it on to the Romans, and the Romans, it said, was bread important? Well, they said it wasn't just a part of the meal, it was the meal, bread. That there were bakers in the Roman culture that had seats in the Roman Senate, that they were so important. So, rice, the rice that we have, when you take the coat off, or your pearl, the pearl rice, which we eat here, we've taken away some of the nutrients. It's just like if you take make wheat flour from a wheat kernel. In other words, you've taken away part of the real goodies of it. And yet this is what is sold in commerce. And that's where this brown rice comes in versus the white rice. We know the white rice, and maybe those people are eating the brown rice. In Japan, 47% of the calories that the population eats is from rice. In the United States, it's 0.8%, so it's less than 1% comes from rice, so that's a comparison. In Burma, 70%. That's getting pretty close to where you're at. 70% from rice. And it's considered sacred in many of these countries. The emperor in Japan still participates in the harvesting of rice, and I believe the planting. I was in Japan one time when they actually, you know, all the school kids and everybody else was offered aid because it was the planting of rice. It's claimed that the emperor of Japan it still grows rice within his the royal palace walls. Now, one of the striking things about rice culture, and this is where many of the other things come into this that are difficult to extrapolate from our conditions to those conditions. I'd like to have your comment. It said that 1,000 hours of labor into 1 acre of rice. Does that sound like it's, that's what the book says? To get 1 acre of rice.
Where is this?
In Southeast Asia. 1,000 hours? That would be, let's see, that would be 200 days, man days.
Or easy.
Easy, you think it's that? That's what the book
easy, yeah.
Now, can you picture 1 acre? You know, that's like four.
Sure.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. 1,000 hours.
You see these people toiling the fields. And of course, you're talking about a year-long production where they have to.
Oh yeah. So then, if they get three times or twice,
maybe two or three crops a year. Right. So they're going to have to take their paddy fields. They're going to have to clear them either by hand or water buffalo. or both. And then they're going to have to get the soil all ready, prepared, and then they take the rice. We've seen it all happen where they plant it individually in a little tufts, maybe two or three plants, but individually. And then they have to go through and they have to weed it and take care of it and then harvest it. And then they start all over again. That's many, many hours.
Yeah, they...
With no machines.
Yeah, and I think when they said 1,000 for an acre, I think that's for one crop. So you'd be 2,000 hours. And I don't have at my fingertips, maybe somebody else is a figure that's tossed around for the number of man hours, let's say, for an acre of Iowa corn. It, the labor hours is not great, but then, of course, you got a lot of machine input into it. So when you think about that culture, it's hard for me to think that this is all going to be disrupted. I just don't think it will be. I think it's going to be a matter, and it shouldn't be. What needs to be done is working with these people and these cultures to get solve the problems as they come up, not change it. In other words, then we get into the terminology, just like alternative agriculture is terminology, then we get in a term called appropriate technology. Appropriate technology. And what is a technology which is appropriate to helping that situation? Now, in the case of rice, there's a long history of improvement, and we only have time to touch on a little bit. There is an international rice research institute in Los Baños in the Philippines. And this was started by money from the Rockefeller Foundation and the Ford Foundation. And to make a long story short, they came up with a new rice variety, cultivar, that was... they called it IR-8. I suppose you hear these terminology, they're up to higher numbers now. But IR-8 was the first, what they call the miracle rice. And Marcos was president of the Philippines, and I guess some of our people, they presented a kilo of this and back and forth. Anyhow, there was a lot of, it was called the miracle rice because of all the excellent work they've done. But the pests and some of the other things caught up with it. In the meantime, they're doing this research, so they've got another one that's coming out that's better. Now let me get, this is about IR-36. I decided to read this to you. Then that same year came IR-36. This would be when you start with IR-1, the first improved rice. Mm-hmm. It has a stiffer stalk that yields more, and so on and so forth. Then that same year came IR-36, more than 7 years in the making. It's, and I just appreciate how diverse it is. Its multi-branched family tree had rice genes from India, Indonesia, the Philippines, Taiwan, Vietnam, and the United States. It was quite a rice. It was resistant, at least at first, to blast, tundro, grassy stunt, bacterial blight, green leaf hopper, gall midge, stem borer, and brown plant hopper. It was well adapted both to irrigated and to rain-fed areas. It was moderately resistant to drought. It was not bothered by soil conditions, being able to tolerate salinity, alkalinity, iron toxicity, boron toxicity, aluminum toxicity, zinc deficiency, and iron deficiency. It matured under ordinary circumstances in 105 to 110 days. So that was shortened up. It had a long, slender, translucent grain, and it cooked well. The International Rice Research Institute nowadays shies away from the use of the word miracle, but it has been willing to dub IR-36, quote, the world's most popular rice, quote. And then it goes on and tells about how that, you know, well over 50% of all the rice that's produced in the world goes back to this work that has been incorporation of all this germplasm base from all these countries into improved. And that work is continuing in the Philippines. And they have over, I believe it's 40,000 lines of rice that they maintain in the Philippines. And The next quote, I think, that I want to give you is that, well, I don't have it available here, but it's a matter of keeping ahead. This is a point we can end on. It's a matter of the people keeping ahead now. Since rice is so important, since wheat is so important, you really have to, you have to be working hard just to keep up with this, because it's a kind of a catch-22. In other words, you got more productivity. But the germplasm base, even though they have this spread out all over that, you see, from all those countries, that the pests, one of those can do an end run on you and take out that crop. And then you've got to have IR-37 ready to go, or IR-38, or IR-39. It's sort of the same thing with the weeds. But this is the way it is. The same, I was reading about rice, the same story was it said in Japan that the yields of rice were like, after the war, they put a push on, they doubled and tripled their rice yields. And so when you think of the major crops, again, that feed us, the corn, the wheat, and rice, those are the other grasses. Those, and then barley is less so, rye and oats and some of these, but those are the major ones, and sugarcane, that the germplasm base on these has in a sense been narrowed down, and there is a certain vulnerability then to disease or pests that could come in and attack that. And that's one of the major concerns that in agriculture today. Because, yes?
I don't know very much about this, but can you mix these? Can you mix them all? I mean, can you make a hybrid of a rice and a wheat to get stronger, or is it just not, there's no way you can
do genetically,
that? It's like putting a cat and a dog together.
No, you can't. Between the cereals, there's only one, and that's not been too successful. There's a hybrid between rye and wheat called triticale that's been worked at for quite a while, and it hasn't really taken off, but it has characteristics of both. And in the animal species, the only cross species hybrid you have is in the case of, and I get this mixed up, a donkey with a, let's see,
horse.
Donkey with a horse, and you get a jackass, or
they get a mule.
They get a mule, right.
But that's not,
but they're sterile.
They're sterile.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So you have to work within the line, the species. And so I don't know if that answers the question.
Yeah, it does.
Because the chromosome numbers have to okay. You know, if you can't otherwise. Now when you get into genetic engineering, now that's another thing that we won't talk about. Genetic engineering takes us into another in other words, you're toying around with what you got on the chromosomes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
See, you're really reading out what you have on the chromosomes, and then you're able to say, well, I can pull off a certain chunk here, and I can replace it, and you know, and that's why a lot of people, you know, really say, hey, man, you know, you shouldn't be fooling with that stuff, because, you know, we might create a monster.